Now, one of the things that I wanted to do, I would be remiss if I did not highlight the fact that this is part of an ongoing seminar series. So the EPA is sponsoring a Federal Facilities Academy, which is comprised of 12 classes in all. There will be 11 webinars that we are hosting live through the Cleanup Information Network. Today is one of them. And then we have a 3-day in-person classroom training opportunity, which is open to a limited audience. So this slide does have the full schedule of the webinars. We've posted the flyer for the full Academy series as well on the seminar homepage. I'll put that in the meeting chat in just a moment as well, so you can download it from there. And you can, if you're able to complete all of the online classes and that in-person delivery, also receive a special certificate of completion for the Federal Facilities Academy. Now, I'd like to walk through that explanation in just a little bit more detail because we do know not everyone can take everything and not everyone is eligible to take all of the classes. So, as I said, there are 11 webinars. Those are all open to the public, and one classroom delivery, which is part of the Academy, which is open to a limited audience. For the online webinars, you may take them live online, just as we're delivering one today, or you may replay a recorded version that will be posted on the Cluin archive page. Both versions, whether it's live or replaying the archive, will count for credit. For the in-person classroom training, you must participate in that event in person, and that is open to a limited audience of only EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. So if you are not working for one of those organizations, you will be ineligible to take that in-person delivery, but you can take all 11 webinars. In order to document your participation, you can get an individual participation certificate for any and all of the online webinars. I'll talk about how to do that at the end, but essentially, you fill out the feedback form, check a box to certify you were here live or replayed the whole thing, and we'll issue a certificate for the webinar. And then, if you either attend, play, whatever combination, all of those online 11 webinars, and you participate in person for that classroom training delivery, you will then be eligible for the Academy certificate, which acknowledges that you did both the online courses and that in-person delivery. And there were questions about when that in-person delivery will be. We do have one currently scheduled for June of this year in Denver, and I'll be including a link to that delivery, in the meeting chat in just a moment. So with those quick reminders, I think we are ready to get started with our class today. So at this time, I'd like to introduce your first instructor, Doug Maddox, who's coming to us from EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration Reuse Office. So Doug, I can see that you are on camera, so I'm going to switch the view over to you. And then I will ask you to share your screen if you can. I'll confirm when we can see your slides, and you can get started with the class today. And the slides are up and look good. Go ahead, Doug.
All right. So welcome, everyone. Introduce myself first, and then I'm going to ask Emily Royal to come on camera and introduce herself. I'm in EPA headquarters, Federal Facilities Restoration Reuse Office in headquarters. I've been there since about 2002. Prior to that, I worked for the Navy and the Army Corps of Engineers. So I've been doing munitions work for a while. I'm an engineer by training, and I do program policy as part of my job, which is a lot of what we're talking about here. I also do a lot of technical support to our regional offices and states and whoever else needs it. I know I'll probably run into quite a few of you, project team meetings and the like. So, hey, Emily, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Emily Royal. I've been with the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office for a little under 2 years now, coming from the State of Tennessee Division of Water Resources. Before that, I did private contracting, and I'm also an engineer by trade, chemical engineering. And I'm happy to help Doug with his presentation today.
So Emily is kind of in training to learn all the munitions stuff and help me out quite a bit. I'll be around for a while longer, but not that long. So we developed this course mainly for our RPMs to kind of bring them up to speed and talk about what's the same with munitions, what's different with munitions, and kind of give them that overview from a regulator's perspective. We've given this online version once. Also, there's some modules in our in-person course, which is not as extensive. We normally had an RPM doing our case study. I get to do that today. and we had a little bit of difficulties scheduling that. So you're going to get to hear me talk a lot today. But why don't we get to it? And I think, first of all, Emily, you can take this one.
Sure. How many years of experience do you have with munitions cleanup? There should be a poll popping up. I am clearly in the 0 to 2 years, and Doug is firmly in the more than 10 years. So we'll wait a moment for answers to come in.
And just a gentle reminder, if you happen to be on a mobile device, sometimes there's an additional pop-up where you may have to manually navigate to that poll looking for the three dots more menu, and you'll see an option to launch that poll. But Emily, it looks like almost 80% of the audience has responded at this time.
Fantastic. Let's see it.
All right. Let me go ahead and end that poll and share the results.
Okay. Wow. 60% in under 2 years. So there's a lot to learn.
Good. Well, that's great. So I think we're hitting great audience, even those who have been around for more than 10 years. Hopefully you will learn some stuff. And if I get it wrong, please feel free to point it out. We'll take questions, try to take questions as we go. Emily's going to help me by monitoring that. If it's something I can answer quickly as we're going, I will. We do have a Q&A session at the end where we can try to get to as many as possible. Some questions we may not be able to answer here, it may take some other coordination or something, but we will get back to you on that. We are tracking all the questions submitted. So let's see, get this going. So this is our course. We're going to talk about, our munitions response authorities under CERCLA, talk through a little bit of the structure of the MMRP program, if you already know that, just follow along. That's the first part. Then we're going to take a short break after talking through that. I am recovering from back surgery, so we had to stick a break in the middle so I can stretch out a little bit. We're going to do a case study, talk through some very interesting issues that have gone on at Fort Ord over time. And then we're going to come back into this presentation, talk through some other specific regs and guidance, talk about detection technologies, a little bit about what they are and why, as well as some policy implications there. UFP QAP. If you don't know what that acronym is, you will know it very soon working in this area. Talk about some partnerships we have going on, and then end out with some unique challenges and kind of why does Doug's phone ring quite a bit with some of these challenges. So let's keep going. This is a cartoon I saw quite a while ago. I've used it in some presentations over the years. And then as I went to a site, I realized, that really does exist. If you have a small screen, I apologize. If you have a bigger screen, if you can see the white flags, those are anomalies. Some of them ended up being mortars that we found. So we do have really current, and this was taken probably within the last eight to 10 years and has been since cleaned up. It was an area they built over and didn't realize that there was munitions areas there when they built the recreation area over top of it. So here we are. Let's talk a little bit about CERCLA, my favorite topic. Removal actions under 104. We'll talk about some remedial actions. Federal facility specific is 120. That's kind of the world I live in mostly. But we do get into we have some private munitions cleanup and work that go on that we do get involved with. If you remember, on-site actions are exempt from administrative and permitting requirements, but we do have to meet substantive requirements under CERCLA, if there's RCRA ARs or whatever. The key point, it's no different. It's the same process for munitions. There's not a different CERCLA. We're not doing CERCLA-like. I know that when I came on board and was doing this in the late 90s, even early 2000s, DoD was kind of doing a CERCLA-like process. No, we're doing CERCLA. It's the same process. Different contaminant, different challenges, different technologies, but same regulatory process. So you don't have to relearn that. You just have to figure out how it fits and where everything goes together. And hopefully this will help somewhat. So here we are. First, to talk about removal actions. We tend with CERCLA, back in the early days when I was actually doing this work for the Army, all munitions work was a removal action. That didn't really fit the way CERCLA was designed. It's more of a combination of removal and then, finishing out with a remedial action. But for removal actions, we have emergency. That's pretty much what it sounds. You got to respond. You got to get there. We will talk later a bit about the munitions rule and some exemptions related to emergencies. time-critical removals. The key there is less than 6 months to plan. It may take years to implement, but you're getting started quickly. And then the 9 time-critical is greater than 6 months to plan. That's more of the, when you talk about a removal action, is usually what we're referring to. This is the world I mostly live in for remedial response. We're trying to get a permanent remedy through our investigation and response. We start with our PA or SI or RFS on out to a record of decision. So we're really looking to implement, you know, the type of remedy. It may include land use controls, institutional controls, soil or groundwater remediation, but you have to meet CERCLA and NCP criteria and NCP expectations, which we will talk about next. But first, we're going to talk about Executive Order 12580, my fun thing. This is the delegation of CERCLA authority. And a lot of functions, it does get kind of complicated where things are delegated between, you know, federal landholding agencies, statutory functions delegated to the EPA administrator. But what really you need to understand is this is why at a cleanup site that DOD, say if it's their land, you know, their site is the lead, they're the lead agency responsible for cleaning up the site, you know, and then they've got to address responsibility when transferring the property. Delegation of authority is subject to Circle 120, which is the federal facilities section. So this federal agency will conduct, you know, the CERCLA response action. And at NPL sites and national priority list sites, which there are quite a few, I think almost 2/3 of the DOD sites have munitions components on them. So we have quite a few munitions components on that. We're actually looking through our databases and reconciling things and trying to track with DOD, making sure we're tracking everything. But for NPL sites, we have to concur and approve the remedial action. That's the difference between that and a non-NPL site. And we have federal facility agreements that are in place at these sites that we've come to agreement, and there are dispute provisions and on and on. And, you know, EPA at the end of the day, at NPL sites, if we don't agree, EPA can select a remedy. And we also have, under the dispute, we do have the final authority for decision. Usually we work, in most cases, work jointly and work through it. Even if we do have some disputes, we get to work through that. That's part of what my office does, is we work with our regional offices and the headquarters DOD offices, try to keep things moving and to get them solved quickly. And honestly, we only get the work done and get the sites cleaned up. State and tribal governments are also consulted and involved. They have their own independent authorities. Some are actually signatories to the federal facility agreement. In some cases, depends on how it's set up.
Doug, we already have a couple of questions. Do you want to go ahead and answer some?
Yeah, when we hit a few questions, see if I can answer them.
Does the EPA have geophysical capabilities internally related to MMRP?
No, we don't do, we have some geophysics equipment and stuff like that with our environmental response teams. Some of our contractors can have that. EPA in-house, no.
Okay, and then how do you fit munitions in CERCLA under a risk range?
I'm going to talk about risk and where it stands. CERCLA, so munitions are an acute risk, and it doesn't fit well with hazard ranking scoring. We can't score a site for a munitions explosive hazard. The ones that have been listed are either for components of the explosives or other contaminants or such like that. So it's a little risk is and risk assessment. I will cover some later. It gets a little bit different because it's not in a chronic, you know, long-term type of risk that we're looking for. And we don't have any cleanup levels for munitions.
Okay. So to be continued, those are all the questions for now.
Okay, great. Those are really good questions. And we could probably spend a lot of time on each talking through. So if I don't get your questions answered all the way, we can certainly talk afterwards. We can ask during the Q&A. I'm very available to help you work through, you know, some of these problems and help you understand them better. So back to CERCLA and NCP, National Contingency Plan, NCP expectations that we're going to treat principal threats. We'll say this very clearly. Munitions can be a principal threat waste. We'll talk about it later. We did have some issues trying to resolve this. It's a site-specific call, but you know, they can be, in a lot of cases they are. So the other NCEP expectation is we want to use a combination of treatment and land use controls, ICs where appropriate. Treatment is really preferred. And, you know, Lux ICs, if we need to use them where they're appropriate, also encourages use of innovative technologies, which I think the DoD MMRP program has done really well with investigative technologies, developing some of the more advanced sensors and capabilities. I will talk through that somewhat in the last section of this course. So talk a bit now about DoD's Military Munitions Response Program, MMRP. I'm going to go through some definitions, talk through, you know, some of the key regulatory drivers. I mean, we're really looking at CERCLA for the main cleanup driver. We do some work under RCRA and others. And we'll talk a little bit about all the other policy and guidances that are out there. So first, what is the MMRP program? DoD has their Defense Environmental Restoration Program. It really has two parts. This is the Installation Restoration Program. IRP is basically anything but munitions cleanup. It's the typical chemical kind of cleanup. The MMRP program started up separate to that. And we are, the MMRP program is somewhat lagging as far as performance metrics and where they are and getting, you know, sites cleaned up and getting to records of decision and stuff compared to the Installation Restoration Program. I think before PFAS hit us and other chemicals, we thought MMRP would be taking over a lot more of the budget and other things by now, but that seems to have slowed it down a bit. So, you know, in 2001, DoD was directed to establish the MMRP program to address munitions response sites. We will talk through definitions. Definitions are very important. I'll talk through UXO, DMM, and MC and what those mean. But really, the MMRP program is only looking on active installations where the sites are closed, formerly used defense sites, FUDs. I know a lot of you familiar with that acronym. Base realignment and closure locations. Actually, that's Fort Ord is one of them, and I'll talk through a case study on that later. MMRP does not address munitions cleanup on operational ranges at all. So what agencies are involved with munitions response? Well, pretty much everybody who does cleanup. EPA, if it's an NPL site, will definitely be at the table. If it is a non-NPL site, we may or may not be there. And DOD, certainly states, tribes, if there's tribal interest, federal land managers, if they're owned, you know, Department of Interior, Department of Ag, a lot of other stakeholders can be involved at any given time, depending on who owns the land, what the land's going to be used for, and such. Here's a brief snapshot of oversight and regulatory offices. I'll start at the bottom. Our regional office, I know there's many EPA folks on the line, and that's kind of our first involvement at the sites. The other four bullets are EPA headquarters offices. And the first is my office, Federal Facilities Restoration Reuse Office, FFRO. We've been around for 25 to 30 years. We're all under the Office of Land and Emergency Management. The Office of Resource Conservation Recovery, ORACR, they handle, that's the RCRA office. So anything permitting, maybe there's a RCRA corrective action or something, it would come to them as far as headquarters office. Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, that's our sister office for Superfund CERCLA cleanup. They're quite a bit bigger than us because they actually do execute some of the work within EPA. Our Federal Facilities Enforcement Office, FEO, is under our Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance at headquarters. All the FFAs, the federal facility agreements and all, and any disputes that arise at federal facilities sites would come up and work through this Federal Facilities Enforcement Office. So DoD's organization, I apologize if this has changed. We actually did run this presentation through DoD headquarters folks before we gave it the last time. So basically, DoD, as far as MMRP, you will hear about Office of Secretary of Defense, which also includes the DoD Explosive Safety Board. They review and approve a lot of the work, the safety side of the work. DoD components, those are the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and DLA. They have secretariat offices, they have staff. DoD likes to kind of reorganize things quite a bit. We do try to stay current with them. From my office, we have quarterly meetings. I was just working on setting up the next one today with the DoD components and talk about kind of program-wide issues and try to resolve them and see, do we need new guidance? Do we need new policy? Do we need to modify something? Is something coming out of another agency that's going to affect what we do? Can we work to, you know, try to make that workable? As far as explosive safety, DoD Explosive Safety Board is all of DoD. There are component explosive safety offices, USTSIS, NOSA for Navy and Air Force Safety Center. So to definitions, and this has recently come, one of the services came to me recently and asked, hey, can we make sure that the EPA people really know what these terms mean? Because I think the quickest way to get to a problem is to think you know what you're talking about, but your words are actually implying something else. So I'm going to go over some of the key definitions here. If you look at some of the reference material that we provided, there are a lot of letters and memos that have the key terminology. If you're writing some letters and other issues, and if you want to run it past me, by all means, I can certainly help with that. So the first one, military munitions, it should be pretty self-explanatory. All types of conventional and chemical ammunition products and their components produced or used by the armed forces for national defense and security. That's pretty easy. Okay. Munitions constituents. Okay. That means any materials originating from unexploded ordnance, discarded military traditions, or other military munitions. That is the, say, the RDX in the soil or TNT or something like that. So I hope you're all still with me. So now we have this new, I want to say newer term. This was, changed in the later 2006 or so. We Army came up with this term and it was adopted DoD wide. So we have munitions and explosives of concern, MEC, and that's the term we use now. It's kind of the overarching term. It includes three different parts: unexploded ordnance, discarded military munitions, and then munitions constituents present in high enough concentrations to pose an explosive hazard. That would be like big bulk explosives. That would be soils with more than 10% explosives constituents in them, stuff like that. That's usually the much lesser used part of this definition, but it's still there. So UXO, unexploded ordnance. This is kind of important to understand the difference here because it's really a safety hazard connotation between things. And I'm going to go through them in this order. UXO would be the more hazardous. Why? Because it's been primed, fused, armed, otherwise prepared for action, and they has been fired, dropped, launched, projected, or placed in such a manner as to constitute a hazard to operations, installation, personnel, or material. But then it remained unexploded either by malfunction, design, or any other cause. So you fired it and it didn't go off and you have no idea why. It's very dangerous. You could go and pick it up and it could go off. You could go pick it up and it does nothing, but you don't know. So any of this, you know, there are ways to tell if things have been fired. And it takes trained personnel to understand what they can do with those. So sometimes you say things cannot be moved. That would likely be unexploded ordnance. Term discarded military munitions means military munitions that have been abandoned without proper disposal. These could be fused, but they haven't been fired. They haven't been put into a condition set to explode yet. Now, if someone, say DoD, tried to blow up some discarded military munitions and it didn't blow them up, it just kind of kicked them out, say at an open burn, open detonation area, we would probably call that unexploded ordnance because it's been placed, it's been hit with such a charge, you don't know the condition of it anymore. And it's really an unknown. Is it really dangerous? Is it not? We don't know. So Emily, we've got a quiz.
We do. And hopefully this is fresh on your mind. What is the difference between UXO and DMM? There is none. UXO has been fired and placed and DMM has not. DMM has been fired and placed and UXO has not. Or UXO is MEC and DMM is not. So take a few seconds, think real hard, get your answers in.
And so, Emily, I'm watching. We've got about almost half the audience having voted. Remember, class gets more fun if you play along with these opportunities. And there are no penalties for a wrong guess. So
it's very important.
Right? All right, I think we might give them a few more seconds. I think we can get to 75% of you having voted. So if you're hedging, just go ahead and go with your gut on this. We're almost there. 72. We can get a few more in. All right, I think I'm going to go ahead and lock it down and we can take a look at how they've voted.
Let's see. Fantastic. 70% got it right. UXO has been fired and DMM has not.
There we go. Awesome. All right, guys. So most of you were paying attention for that one. I did just turn my video off because I want to try to ease the burden of having to look at me the whole time and maybe not have to have video running if you're on a lighter bandwidth. So let's go to the next slide. This is one of the questions I get asked quite a bit. So I wanted to make you aware of this when we're talking about DoD and what's there. Their MMRP site inventory. DoD has worked really hard over the years. EPA assisted and states did in the mid-2000s with trying to get a really good handle on their inventory. DoD really required them to inventory their sites and then prioritize their sites. This is part of the inventory. You know, a number of them, and then talking about funding that's obligated to clean up these. The first link is the annual report to Congress. It's usually about posted up not too long after the fiscal year ends. I didn't look to see what the latest was up there, but the second link is actually the inventory, and you can search it by state, pull up your site, and get some basic information in there. There could be some polygons in there of the site and all that, and then get the contact info of who to get more info from. So this is, you know, good to look at to see, you know, are you actually working your ammunition site, or if the site you have is what phase it is under with DoD. So this is the second part of that. The first was them inventorying their sites. The second was coming up with a prioritization scheme for their site. So DoD established the protocol and looking at evaluating the primary hazards at the munitions response sites. There's three modules in there. They have to score at least one. The first is the one where I spend the majority of the time in. Explosive hazard evaluation module. And the second is chemical warfare material evaluation. The third is health hazard evaluation module for more from constituents. This is the tool they use to do the national level ranking. We're supposed to review and update each munitions response priority at least annually to reflect any new information that affects the MRS priority. You should see this as they go. The scores go from 1 to 8, 1 being the most dangerous, 8 being the least. 1 would be only chemical warfare. The explosive hazard evaluation starts at 2. So if you had a 2 for a, you know, regular explosives munition site, that would be a pretty high priority. I think most of those are at least in progress, the 2s, the 3, 1, 2s, 3s, 4s even. And some of them, they may actually pair together. They may have lower priority sites, but they're adjacent to higher priority sites. And for, you know, ease of response and, you know, being fiscally responsible, they may do some of the lower priority sites along with some of the higher priority sites. But you can see this information and when you get involved in your site.
Doug, we have a couple of questions.
Sure. Hit it.
Does the inventory include FUD sites?
If they have an MMRP component, yes. And they're actually listed out. And, you know, actually, next time I do this, I might put a few screenshots to show that. When you do a search by state, it will actually come up with Army, formerly used defense sites, Air Force, Navy, on down. It'll be split out that way. If it's not MMRP, it won't be in there. There are a lot of FUDs that are just chemical contamination, and they would not be listed there.
Okay.
But FUDs, one thing though, FUDs does have their own database of all FUD sites. So those kind of overlap with the MMRP component.
Okay. And then one more question. Does the EPA rely completely upon contractor geophysics for input, review, et cetera? Geophysicists, my apologies.
Wow. Somewhat. We do have experienced RPMs that have done this. Part of my job is also reviewing this. I actually helped write the UFP QAP and other things, and have been around geophysics for a long time. But for specific geophysicist support, yes, we do have regional support contracts that support each region. And we've just redone a lot of those. We've had some periods of time where the regions did not have coverage, and I actually had to help fill in somewhat. We are also even looking at a national level contract that our regions can buy into for very much more specific support, along the lines of advanced classification, UFP QAP review, and those types of things. Are there any others?
Nope, that's it for now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. So we're going to keep on. The one thing to go along with this munitions response site prioritization protocol, they do have a primer document that's more of an explanation of the document, how it's used and going through. I recommend reading that first, and that's in our references or easily available on DoD's website. So some of our unique challenges. We have no promulgated regulatory standards or safe levels. And for this, I'm talking about UXO munitions, the explosive hazard. We don't have, there's no how clean is clean. We don't have a risk. Talking about risk, it's an acute hazard. Direct interaction may cause serious injury or death. These are discrete hazardous items. We're not talking about plumes. There may be plumes associated with constituents, but that's not what I'm talking about here. And they can be an attractive nuisance. I am not a fan of signs and fences for long-term responses. I've had several teenagers raise several of them, and I think they would all be attracted to that. It's military stuff. Cool. There's a danger sign. Let's go check it out. We've had a lot of trespass issues, and that's really somewhat dangerous. The problem with coming up with a standard, how many UXO per acre is safe? There's no answer to that question. None, really. But how do you know you've gotten them all? And what is there a statistical way of understanding that? It gets very complex. We'll talk a little bit about risk assessment later. There have been some strides forward, a few back, a few more forward in more recent years, and trying to get things standardized in that. So the other thing with munitions, and we stuck with the Fort Ord theme here. These are actual munitions found at Fort Ord. You'll have a variety of site conditions. We might have vary greatly in size and topography. I do know at Fort Ord, they were rappelling down some very steep areas to try to survey. They had some munitions in a very steep hillside. I think at Fort Ord, there were over 300 types of munitions that were found cleaning up there. And this is just some of them. It's not even a quarter of the ones that were found. These are all boards they used in public meetings and such. So some of our other challenges, technology limitations. How can we find them? We're relying on finding, when they're in the ground, finding the metal that's there. We don't have explosive detectors. We don't have munitions detectors. We have metal detectors. And how good are they? And there's different types. There's analog, there's digital. We've worked with DoD developing some advanced classification. We can tell between items that are underneath, but that comes with a cost. Munitions cleanups can be many orders of magnitude greater than traditional contaminants. It could be less if, depending if you're looking at a huge groundwater plume versus cleaning up a smaller area. We've worked with DoD trying to refine some of these detection technologies to be able to leave some non-hazardous items in place. And do we know the certainty of that? And how can we accept that? So we got another quiz.
Right. DERP is an acronym for what? Deterring Explosives Restoration Program, Defense Environmental Restoration Program, Dangerous Environment Response Program, or Defensive Engagement Response Program. So get your answers in. We'll wait a little while.
It does look like the audience is a little bit more confident in their choices on this one.
I would have thought so.
Glad to hear it.
And we're looking at about 2/3 having voted right now. And remember, if your button or your cursor is floating between two circles, just go with one. Trust your gut instinct, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to go ahead, if it's all right with you, Emily, I'm going to close these polls down and Absolutely. Let's take a look. All right. So there are the results.
94% got it correct. Well done. Happy to hear it.
Good
Defense
job.
Environmental Restoration Program.
All right. So I think we were on schedule for our
Yeah, we're
first
doing
break.
Well time-wise. We can go
okay.
ahead and do five.
So let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break. And then we will come back and get started. I've got a video of some stuff blowing up, so we can make it a little interesting to wake you up.
All right. Thanks so very much. So ladies and gentlemen, we'll go ahead and take a quick 5-minute break. You will hear silence on the webinar during that time. I'm going to start a helpful timer on the screen, though, and we should see you back here for the resumption of the class in approximately 5 minutes. All right, it does look as though our 5-minute break has concluded. I'll check to see if we have Doug Maddox back with us.
I am back.
Wonderful, Doug. So you should be able to take it over.
I'm going to try. Let's see if we can do the screen. And that didn't work. Okay. Gene, can you see that?
I cannot. I'm going to go ahead and help you out here because remember, you have to override me. I'm going to stop sharing.
Yeah, there we go.
And I there you it. Go.
Thank you. So we're going to first share. So the first thing, I wanted to start off with just a quick video to show you kind of the power of explosives and how a site can switch quickly from a removal to an emergency. So this was Camp Minden site we were involved with. It was a removal action, a lot of unstable explosives, propellants were found there in storage. We worked with DOD and the state to get things on track. We had a very nice contained burn unit set up to process these tens of millions of pounds of material. Unfortunately, during that process, a couple of the bunkers leaked and got wet. Some of the material got very, very, very unstable when it was wet. One of the bunkers detonated. And then we were unable to go into any of those two other bunkers that had that material. Luckily, it was the small amount. We didn't have that much material, this type of material, clean burning igniter at the site. But this is what was the resultant
safe to move out of the
explosion.
Bunkers. And so we were called out
when we had to set it off.
Disposing of it on time in a timely manner. It definitely reduces the hazard to pretty much everybody around.
Fire in the hole! Fire in the hole! Fire in the hole, fire in the hole.
So you can see that's about 150,000 pounds, that explosive weight going off. The reason was no one could enter the bunker. No one could handle the materials because it got so completely unstable. So I thought that was an interesting video. So we're going to go back now to doing our presentation. Give me 1 second. Where we're actually shifting gears now. We're going to talk through a case study at Fort Ord. And again, I apologize. Normally we'd have one of our RPMs doing that. That didn't get worked out in time for this. So I'm going to talk through this case study. So Fort Ord is kind of located outside of, on the central coast of California, adjacent to Monterey Bay, south of San Francisco. Santa Cruz is to the north, Monterey and Carmel are to the south. I have to say, I've walked over the site. It's a very beautiful piece of property with some amazing views. The yellow dotted line you can see is actually the site. You can see all the cities around there. The pink area, the impact area track 3, is what we're going to talk through a little bit today for our case study and some interesting things that had happened there. A lot of the firing points were around the perimeter, firing in. So the majority of the mech has been found in this part of the site. There are a lot of other areas on the base that were used for munitions training. This was not the only site, although it was the most heavily contaminated. Fort Ord was put on the NPL list in 1990. There were a lot of different reasons for that. It was officially closed in 94 under the second round of BRAC, and it was the largest U.S. base to be closed at that time. So my office has been involved with the site with Region 9 for quite a number of years. So let's go to the next slide. So it is a little bit of background on it. It started in 1917 as a horse garrison, again, closed in 94. So it was really training and staging for infantry troops. A lot of acres. In fact, Fort Ord is approximately the size of the city and the county of San Francisco. That's very big. Types of mech, artillery, projectiles, rockets, hand grenades, practice landmines, pyrotechnic bombs, and demo materials. Pretty much if it was in the inventory and it was Army-based, it was likely used here at some point in time. They did come up with the three reuse, the three E's, economy, education, and environment. This was very popular land. It's very, very expensive area. So there was a really strong desire to clean it up and reuse it. The property value was very high. Actually, Ford Erd won a 2020 Excellence in Site Reuse Award, which is sponsored out of our office in the BRAC NPL category. We do that every year. There was a privatized cleanup here, although we're not going to go through that partial, but in 07, Army funded the Ford Erd Reuse Authority to clean up, to conduct a MET cleanup on over 3,000 acres. They finished that cleanup in 2020. There's a lot of land use control implementation that's ongoing. I think at the time, this was one of the earliest and biggest privatized cleanups in the country. So what we're going to talk about a bit is the impact area. This is, it's a 6,500 acres, part of the Fort Ord National Monument, threatened and endangered species, this central maritime chaparral, which is what we will focus on a little bit. The ROD was signed in 2008 after a lot of back and forth. I was involved in that one. A lot of the language and stuff that we take for granted now that that's, you know, everybody agrees to was not that way in 2008. So this involved some prescribed burns and vegetation cutting. We'll show you some pictures as we move along a little bit why that was needed in this area. The entire area got a technology aided surface clearance of MEC. And then they did subsurface remediation in selected areas, roads, trails, other areas that were selected. It was about 10% of the area that got the subsurface controls. There were a lot of institutional controls, land use controls, construction support, access controls, habitat management. And then they did some digital surveys post-cleanup. So why do they need to do prescribed burns, the first part of that. This has been in the news many times over the last 15 plus or so years. It's home, this impact area is home to the largest growth of the Central Maritime Chaparral in California, and which is also the home of multiple endangered plants and wildlife. So prescribed burns are required to protect and preserve the endangered species habitat because many of these species are fire dependent. And to protect these species, prescribed burn season is limited to summer and fall from July to December. And it's very, very hard to get it to fit within that sometimes. So why are we doing it? For the cleanup reason is really, if you look in the upper left photo, some of that vegetation is over 6 feet tall and it's extremely dense. MEC is underneath there, hard to see, hard to get to. You know, the post-burn, you can clearly see the MEC that's on the surface in those areas. You know, these prescribed burns make it ground surface accessible. They also, you know, reduce overgrown vegetation, which in turn reduces the risk of wildfires. California is a pretty tough state to get burns approved in, but it was, you know, we did get burns approved and done for this reason, because we can actually protect the habitat and clean up some of the major problems there. Let's see. So to do these burns, we had to do some fuel break cutting. You can see the before and after photos. We left the oak tree standing. They were limbed up and they survived the fire. This is the primary containment line. There were a primary, secondary, and tertiary for each burn area to ensure community safety. Some of the parcels actually identified it could not be burned, and they had to be cut due to the proximity of neighborhoods or airports. So we're going to try to do this. And Gene, I think I shared the screen wrong to do this, but we'll give it a, I'm going to actually reshare. If you give me a second. To share sound. Let's see if this is going to open.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hockley from Sandy Hook Promise. I know this is hard to hear.
There we go. Skip ahead. Here we are.
So my name is Bill Collins. I'm the environmental coordinator for the Army's Base Realignment Closure Office at former Fort Ord. We're out here today conducting a prescribed burn on 265 acres of the former Fort Ord. It's part of the Fort Ord National Monument. It's being done to help support the ongoing munitions cleanup of the area. Once the burn is done, the UXO unexploded ordnance technicians will be able to safely enter the site and look for any explosive hazards.
Doug, right. While you're transitioning back, we have a couple of questions.
Sure. Go ahead.
While signs are not ideal, they may be the only option to warn folks about the hazard. There are those who take them to heart. Will you be covering other options?
To signs or
yes.
Cleanup? I mean, yeah, my personal preference is if you can clean it up and not have the need to put signs in and stuff, I personally, you know, we'll follow the NCBP expectation for treatment. Signs and fences are useful in some circumstances. I agree. I don't like them kind of as a default, nor do I like just land use controls as a default. You know, I think cleanup should certainly be evaluated.
Okay. What is the depth of surface versus subsurface?
Anything visible from the surface. So when you talk about surface clearance, if it's an item that's sticking out and you can see it, that would be taken care of. We do a detectorated surface clearance sometimes just to look at it. There's actually a picture coming up. I'll show you when if there's brush or other things on the ground, you can survey to see if there's anything there that rings off, and you can see then if it's underneath the brush or not. But that's really, it's got to be seen from the surface.
Okay. And then conventional munitions such as military flares may contain as much as 45% PFAS. Has any soil testing for PFAS been conducted at Fort Ord? As highly persistent bioaccumulative contaminants, they would expect to be a concern for ecological systems and receptors.
So I'm not the RPM and I can't answer that, but I would certainly, we can get back to you on that. I don't want to answer incorrectly.
Okay.
PFAS is kind of a evolving thing at sites. So it's certainly, I think, being discussed and looked at.
Okay. And then, so does fire not trigger the UXOs to explode?
It can. And that's, but again, as far as a safety concern, you know, they're going to be, no one will be near them when they do that. But as opposed to trying to cut through the brush and move it and have them go off when someone's nearby, I mean, that's the real reason for doing the burn in certain circumstances like that.
Okay, so that was our last question at this time. So you can go sure. On back.
All right. So here's the before and after picture. You can tell that they kept it contained to an area. It is very difficult. I do recall over the years, many delays with having to do this. You have to have the absolute correct conditions to do this to ensure which way the smoke's going to go and how you can contain the fire and not too much wind and on and on. So it was not an easy thing to get set up and do. So moving on, this is the picture I mentioned before. This is an area where they actually had cut down some brush. They're using, those are Schonstadt magnetometers. They're using to do a surface clearance, and they're trying to see, you can see some of the cut brush and other things that are on the surface, and they're trying to see, you know, is there something underneath there, and then they can flag it for being dealt with later. Analog, I will talk about the difference between analog and digital detection methods later, and the utility and use of each, and the kind of pros and cons is from a policy perspective. So the next, digital geophysical mapping, used a lot of different methods here. Basically, same technology, different platforms here. You're able to geo-reference your geophysical mapping area. You do not get that with this type of work. Right now, here, you're getting a sound and maybe a flag in the ground or finding an item. There's no real record of this. You will get that from the DGM work, which would also include some of the advanced classification, which I think is the next slide. This is one of the earliest versions of MetalMapper, which is an advanced geophysical classification AGC system. And I'll talk through these a little bit. What this is a more easiest way to describe it, a three-dimensional look at your object in the ground, looking at characteristics and how things decay from the electromagnetic pulse and all. And we can tell very reliably between different size items and different shape items. Like a flat plate looks entirely different than a cylindrical, heavily walled object, which we would think would be a munition. I worked with DOD, EPA did, and states partnering on this technology for a better part of 10 years to ensure this is not a black box and it really does work. This is one of the sled-mounted early-on systems. It wasn't the most durable or easiest to get out to a site. They're cart-mounted now, 2x2 arrays, Metal Mapper and TEMTADs that are much more useful getting into place.
While you're on the slide, we have a question for you.
Go back. Let me go back.
Is follow-up post-clearance BGM always required?
It depends. It depends on what your end use of the site is going to be and what endpoint you would be wanting to get to. You know, and depends on what technology you use to clear the site originally. So I'd say it depends. And I think you need to look at the level of data quality and uncertainty minimization you need. If you were trying to get, say, to an unrestricted UUUE scenario or no further action, whatever you want to call it, I would say yes. If you know you're having land queues controls coming into place and all, and you've done a really good job with QAQC throughout the process, possibly not. If you used analog technologies and you want to get to a better endpoint, you might want to, you know, there are uses for analog technologies. You could maybe thin out the area and, you know, and remove a lot of anomalies and then go back and map the area out and dig. So you could even use a combination of those.
Okay. I've got two more for you.
Sure.
Do all sites get sampled for perfluorate?
Depends on what was done there. If it was in the munitions that were used or propellants that were used there, then it should be one of the analytes when they're sampling.
Okay. Has any equipment like this triggered a UXO?
No. No. And that's, we've not had anything, the MAG system is passive. The EM is not enough to set it off. There are some newer munitions that could be, I guess there could be an issue with. We don't normally see those on these type of cleanup sites. That would certainly be a discussion to be had with your munitions experts on your project team. But no, it's not very common that it would be an issue.
Okay, getting some more for you. Are they still using metallic seeds for quality assurance?
Yes. So seeding, and we can talk about this in a little bit. Again, we're getting a little deep here, but the way we do quality now is you can test your instrument out. And then at the site, as you're doing your geophysics like this, we are actually, the contractor is going to place their seeds. And these are either simulated objects like a pipe that's the same size as your munition, they're called industry standard objects, or you can even have inert munitions. Some DOD has some of those. They're the exact same thing you're looking for. You're going to place, the contractor will place those, make sure that people are finding them. And then the government, DOD, will place quality assurance seeds in as well to make sure that things are being found and they're being found at the depths that they should be able to be found. And that's all part of the geophysical systems verification process. Are there any more questions?
That was the last question for now.
Great. All right. And that, at that point, we're starting to get a little deeper with those questions, but those are really great questions. And I'm glad you're thinking along those lines of data quality, because I am a regulator and I need good data quality to be able to make good decisions. Here's a typical geophysical map that you could get out of. I think this was a DGM. This was not an advanced classification surveyor, though you could get a similar map for that. This is a EM61 survey, and it's sometimes called a false color scale, but basically you've set it up that certain higher numbers of anomalies will trigger different colors. In this area, the pink reddish color is the higher density areas. So you can kind of see, hey, this is where we may be focusing in on some of the work and how you want to, where you want to spend your time and money. for removal. A little couple pictures of some digging, some anomalies. I don't know about this one, you know, they provided this, but I usually don't see that many, you know, two teams right next to each other digging, but I guess it could be done. That's up to the site team and the safety folks to do that. What they're doing is digging at the location and using instrumentation to make sure that there's nothing left there. One thing to keep here, there may not just be one munition per location. There could be several. And some of the more advanced classification system, we could tell. We may not if it's too dense of an area. So you can keep that in mind.
Quick question.
Sure.
How do the density maps correlate to range fans for sight?
So what you would do, and this is really, we partner with DOD on a training class for RIFS. We're actually going to do one, hopefully, and we just did one online. We'll do one in person where we teach how you go about investigating a site, you know, going through the RIFS process. And we're really trying to, you know, you have your range maps and all, and you would hope if they use the range as intended and as they had drawn up, you know, that's one point of weight of evidence of those maps and stuff. How do they correlate to the actual data you get? I have seen some where they didn't, and I've seen a lot where they did. You would expect, you know, maybe these, you know, unfortunately at Fort Ord, you've got crisscrossing ranges firing inwards. So they're overlapping. So it's very hard to tell which is from what, but you would expect at the target impact area, you would have a much higher density and that it would taper off through the range fan area back to the firing point. And maybe the firing point could have some little higher density areas if there was some disposal done. Are there any more?
That was all for now.
Cool. Great. So this is just a slide showing you what some of the munitions look like at Fort Ord. Again, they had everything ranging from small arms up to 155 millimeter projectiles, a bunch of mortars here. That's a 40 millimeter grenade, high explosive on the upper right. So a lot of different stuff. The key point here is some of this stuff, you know, look at the lower left, may not look like a munitions item when it's in the ground. You know, I've got lots of pictures of things that look like just rocks sticking out, and they're not, they're bombs. So be very careful if you're on a munition site and work with your experts on identifying it. So, institutional controls, education and outreach. So, you know, trespassing is a huge, huge issue at Fort Ord. Especially, you know, when people are trying to get off the beaten track. Like I said, Fort Ord is a beautiful place. I've walked a lot of the areas over many years. There's a lot of biking and outdoor stuff there that goes on there. They do have to use, you know, it's kind of a layered approach, land use restrictions, access restrictions, or signage and fencing. There's construction support, that if certain things are going on there, they have to first go through this training. You can click on that link and you can run through the training and see. They're even looking, there's helicopter use for habitat management. They're also looking into drones and cameras. There's a ton of education and outreach with local school. This is a very population dense area around this. They have done a lot of school outreach at public events. They've had open houses and tours. And, you know, they just keep trying to work through that. So we've got a few pictures of signs here. You know, signs and fences work well in some areas, some other sites they really don't work well on. I know Vieques, another NPL site, we put up some fences in the temporary before and they're gone by the next weekend. So haven't had the problem at Fort Ord. Here's some of the outreach material. The three R's, recognize, retreat, report, is DOD's website. It's 3Rs.mil. I believe that's in our references as well. They have a ton of just different outreach materials, pamphlets, coloring books, anything that they can, you know, train folks, different languages, pointing to different sectors, marine industry, on and on and on. Again, there's one of the boards in the upper right. You can see the different munitions. I think that's the same board we had in the previous picture. So far, I think these are the numbers as of about a year ago, estimating it complete in 2030. They've had over 79,000 MEC items recovered. Of those, 12,000 plus were high explosive, over 300 types of munitions found. For the privatized area, again, almost 5,000 munitions item and just tons of debris and other things that were gone through. Like I said, this is pretty valuable property. So I do think maybe some more money was spent trying to develop it and make it safe for those uses that may not have necessarily been done elsewhere. So some of the lessons learned from this, you know, munitions cleanup is really resource intensive. It is. Long-term efforts are required in a lot of cases. Lux ICs, five-year reviews are brought in. I get asked the question a lot, can you get to unrestricted use, you know, unlimited exposure? Maybe. It's hard. It's not easy. And it involves some really upfront planning and a lot of good quality through your investigation. Collaboration and innovation, innovative thinking is key. A lot of things basically started out of Fort Ord, some risk assessment work and looking at things and working through project team things. We're still using some of that today in some of our newer methodologies. And then again, local knowledge and perspectives are important. There are a lot of people interviewed through this whole Fort Ord project and getting really good information about what was done, where things may have been disposed, how they actually did activities versus what was planned. So you really cannot discount that first line information. So any other questions on this? I want to especially thank Judy Hong, who's done this in person. Maeve Clancy did this last time for us out of EPA Region 9. And Melissa Rodson and Stan Cook also contributed to the presentation.
We have one question. We have a couple questions. The density map showed higher density up to a border. Are there policies for stepping out of the investigation area?
The simple answer to that is, you know, as a regular, CERCLA follows the extent of contamination. Okay. And yes, that now maybe it was done as a separate parcel. You know, maybe DOD wanted, for whatever reason, we wanted to have this MRS versus this MRS, but certainly it will all be covered under CERCLA and cleaned up or addressed somehow. How it is done as far as which rod covers what, and as long, you know, I have the opinion, as long as it's all done, cleaned up and managed safely, that, you know, we're going to work through it and get it done the easiest and quickest way we can. That makes sense. I hope that answers that question.
One more. Are the DGM surveys conducted on a transect that cover every square foot of the investigation area, or is the mapping system able to interpolate across larger areas?
Yeah, that's a little more technical question. So that map was 100% coverage. You can do, if you're, say, looking for a target area, you can do what's called transects, and you can space them out so that, hey, if you're looking for a certain size target, we're looking for a mortar target that's 150 meters in diameter or something along those lines. We have some standard approximate sizes of those types of targets. We can design a transect survey to find those targets. And then the VSP system visual sample plan can kind of create the numbers and kind of give you that map showing the approximate. So the more data you have, obviously, the more accurate it is. So you want to keep in mind what you're looking for. And keep in mind, if you're doing transects, keep in mind the object of your investigation. You know, what are you looking for? Are you trying to find targets? Then maybe you can do transects and you can say, at the end of the day, you don't find any targets. Okay, we don't have any targets here. But you didn't do your resolution of your investigation was not enough to say, hey, there aren't any munitions here, because you've left gaps. So if you really, you know, it depends on the intent of your investigation. And again, that's the 2-day course. It's 3 days online and 2 days. We did record the first day, the presentation materials. And we're going to try to make that available that folks can watch. And we're actually starting to try to do the 2-day course in person, maybe at the end of June. We're still working on that. So contact me if you're interested in that as well, because that's going to be covered in much grander detail in that course.
Can you talk about any problems with past prescribed burns?
I think the problems we've seen really are trying to get them done in a timely manner. The problem really is meeting the conditions. There were a few fire jumps that were handled, and that's kind of the thing. If conditions change as things are going, that's why they're very, very strict conditions to begin with and trying to forecast. I can't remember the number of times things got that canceled a few years in a row. But really it would be more of a, jumping a fire line, which there were some minor occurrences of that.
Is there a policy for gathering data where terrain is problematic, for an example, heavily wooded areas or slopes?
So we'll talk a little bit about technology and when to use what in the next presentation. So let's hold that until I get through the next part of the presentation. So if I haven't answered that at the end, please re-ask.
Okay, and no further questions at this time.
Cool. All right, so I am gonna try to switch presentations here. Yeah, we're back. There we go. Okay, we're done with the four-door case study. So I've got probably about 15, 20 minutes left of talking through some more specific things. I'm going to hit some technology as well and talk through, hopefully answer some of those questions. So a little bit about EPA guidance. So RCRA, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, is a waste management statute. It's the source of the Military Munitions Rule, which was published in 1997. For RCRA, authorized states may exercise the RCRA authorities. In some states are not authorized, and EPA retains that authority. There are a lot of things under RCRA, characteristic tests, management standards for hazardous waste. The last ones is management standards for open burning, open detonation, OBOD. That's been a big topic du jour lately. My office is participating, but we are not driving that. That is out of our Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, or ROCR, at headquarters, are working through alternative technology for OBOD, looking at putting out some guidance soon, and then actually working on possible rulemaking. I'll talk about that in a little while. The Military Munitions Rule, the big part of this, it avoids imposing RCRA Subtitle C statutory authority on operational ranges. We exempted munitions used for their intended purpose and remain on operational ranges from the regulatory definition, of solid waste. Okay, so if there is an operational range, they fire it down range and things don't go off, they don't necessarily have to clean it up right away because they're going to continue to use it. If things go off range, they have to clean them up. If they dispose of things on the range, that was not covered under this either. Also, the munitions rule identifies when military munitions would become waste under some management and talks through other relationships. Well, my computer's not working. Ah, here we go. There are some exemptions under there. I don't really need to go through other than the third one, munitions used in training, R&D, testing evaluation, and then range clearance of active, inactive. The old term, so terminology is kind of important. The old term active or inactive ranges was around when I started this job, and it would quickly change to, so if you see active/inactive, that means operational ranges. Inactive just means maybe they're not using it now, but they're still retaining it as an operational range. So DOD has the authority to kind of say, these are our operational ranges and we're using them. So other things that would be subject to RCRA, abandoned munitions, on-range disposal, landfilling of munitions, those things are not covered under the munitions rule exemption. One thing munitions rule did try to clarify was for emergency response. I've had interaction with folks in and out with our explosive ordnance disposal folks, military specialists. Those folks responding to an explosives or munitions emergency, they can take the action. They don't need to get a permit. They don't need to make notifications. However, that is granting them the authority to do what action needs to be taken to immediately resolve the situation. These are some guidelines. So we wrote these, and it took a very long time to get issued. These are still fairly current EPA Munitions Response Guidelines. This is probably our most straightforward guidance on munitions. It's 30 something pages. This is the framework to our regional officers overseeing responses. And this is, again, a little bit older technology that locations other than operational ranges. So basically when you're responding, you know, doing our MMRP program cleanup. And it's how to work with DOD and where we fit in the process. And this is in our references as well. Sorry. Under this, talking through general regulatory authorities, RCRA, CERCLA, explosive safety principles, site characterization, geophysical detection techniques, and preference for, EPA, we have a really big preference for digital methods. We want a record. There was a document from 2001, the UXO management principles that EPA and DOD signed, where we agreed DOD should be going in this way. It's taken about 20 years, but I think DOD agrees with us too, that digital and georeference data is the way to go. And talking through some luck and IC issues and enforcement. Fit all that into a 30-page document. So some of the current policy issues that are ongoing, I'll talk through these for a little while. Munitions as a hazardous waste, hazardous substance. It's not so much an issue now. On a closed site that's being cleaned up, there's not a big disparity anymore. There's a section in enclosure in the DERP manual that DOD has that talks about their opinions on it. Our EPA munitions response guidelines talks about our opinions, and that, you know, these things are not necessarily a waste when they're on an operational range, but when the range closes or it's put to a use incompatible, you know, those things at some point are not exempt anymore. They become a hazardous waste and a CERCLA hazardous substance. You know, we don't have a big necessarily disagreement with that anymore. Back in the mid 2000s at Fort Ord, we did. So that's mostly resolved. Principal threat waste determination. This is a site-specific determination at a site, but munitions in themselves are dangerous and pose a severe hazard to personnel. In a lot of cases, UXO and or DMM can be a principal threat waste and should be identified as such. Again, it's a site-specific determination. We've kind of worked out some language with DOD that goes into records of decision about how that, you know, should be discussed. And if any more is found, it should be evaluated to see if it's a principal threat and needs to be treated there. I think the biggest number one question I get asked is this third bullet. Can we get to unlimited use, unrestricted exposure, UUE? Some of the DOD services call it no further action. Basically, you're completely done with the site and you're walking away. Have you cleaned it up to the level that you want to clean it up to? Can we get there? When I started this job at EPA about 20 years ago, I would have said no. And the reason being, we were not at that level of technology and procedures and QAQC and the way of minimizing uncertainty at a site and maximizing our use of these technologies and quality assurance and all. We have made very great strides in the last 20 years, I think, working with DOD on technology, on working on QAQC. I will talk through the UFP QAP use a little bit later. So my answer now is maybe. And it depends really on the type of site. There's so many factors that fill into this. I can tell you what has happened at a few sites in the past few years where they've had 20 years of work. They've done analog investigations. They've done some cleanup. They've had some contractors they had to get rid of due to, you know, poor practices. And then they come to us and say, well, we think we got it all. So we're UUE, right? No, in those cases, we were not convinced. And the question was, well, what can we do? And I said, well, the answer is, the good news is you've already done a lot. Bad news is, so when you go back and do, you know, more to convince us, you know, there's probably a lot less there. So I think the answer there is start it from the beginning. I could plan a better looking ahead investigation and cleanup to try to get to that endpoint than I can to try to fit what everything that has been done into that. That's a much more difficult situation. And again, it depends on land type, do you have a lot of hot rocks? Is your geology interfering with your instrumentation? How good was your QHQC? How did you have any failures? What technology are you using? You know, on and on and on. We do have some examples coming out in the new UFP QAP module 2. I'll talk about in a little bit, talking through this kind of scenario and what we would look for. Someone had mentioned post geophysical survey, post verification survey. I'm shaking my head now. I don't have video on, but yes. In a case like this, where you're trying to get to UE, I would want that. I would ask for that as something to help, you know, minimize the uncertainty. Again, depends on the site and what you're going to do there. Risk hazard assessment. This has been an interesting one over the years. Risk, it's an acute, munitions, and I'm talking about the explosive risk, not the chemical. There are ways of doing risk assessment for chemicals, RDX, TNT, other things. We have established methods for that. For doing the explosive threat from the munitions, Fort Ord actually started out one of these in their SMART team. And what we saw back in that timeline, early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, there were several different methods for trying to do this. None of them were actually great. EPA partnered with DOD, came up with a MEC hazard assessment in the mid-2000s. That's still out today. That's really a relative tool to compare and contrast alternatives in your feasibility study. It shows you kind of the risk reduction between doing different alternatives. There's no absolute risk methodology per se, and it's difficult to do so. DOD undertook probably 6-ish, 7 years ago, they developed their own internal, it was originally called the Remedial Action Alternative Tool, and now it's the Risk Management Methodology. They issued it draft for trial at FUDS sites only, because that's a lot of what the Army Corps of Engineers does. I think 2017 timeframe, they kept extending that. It's a different kind of tool. It's similar input factors to MECHA. They do come out with an acceptable and unacceptable answer. The regulators were not involved in the development of that tool. I've been through it a lot. We actually just worked through one of our national work groups and gave a lot of comments on the tool. DOD came out with a second draft version, which we reviewed and submitted a bunch of comments, and that was last month. So hopefully they can take those comments back, get a newer version out. At some point, we might get to a joint tool that everybody agrees to. It's very difficult work. I think, though, you can use either tool and work through it in your project team and come to a good decision at your site. There shouldn't be a lot of surprises running these tools. There's not a lot of different scenarios for cleanup and endpoints and land use controls. You shouldn't run the tool and go, huh, that one's actually safe. You really should know. And this is a way of proving it and going through the process. So let's see. Detection technology. All right. So we talked about this a little bit. There's really two ways of finding MEC, UXO, DMM. Magnetic, which is passive. Electromagnetic induction, which is active. That's the two ways. Ground penetrating radar and other methods really don't work well. There is a technology document put out by CERTA PSTCP, that's DOD's research arm. I think it was around 2006, with looking at different historical methods of this and talking through what is the best. But this is really where we are. For these types of MAG or EM, there's digital systems, which is digital geophysical mapping, where you record all the data, it's geo-referenced, and then you can analyze the data and identify the anomalies to go back and dig. Compare that with analog systems, whereas also, you know, previously called mag and flag, mag and dig. There's no record of it, and the real-time analysis identifies the anomalies by sticking a flag in the ground where they come back and dig later. That's highly dependent on the user and factors we cannot control. How well is his hearing going this day? Did he actually sweep and cover the whole area? We don't know for sure. So we really have pushed a lot from the regulatory side and actually even within DOD now to minimize the use of analog systems to where they really have to be used. And someone mentioned before the terrain. In our training that we teach, that I seem to always, I'm one of the regulators on the train, I seem to always get stuck with the steep terrain breakout group where we end up having to use analog systems, which is good for me because I can talk through the limitations and all that. But really, you can't get a push cart. You can't get the top picture here. You can't get that on a 40 degree slope versus that. So it's kind of the, hey, we get what we can get data wise, but you have to really understand the limitations of it. In my mind, if you're thinking that you can want to get to a UUE scenario, you should not be using analog systems. That's just too much uncertainty. You're in the 40 to 70% detection range for buried objects. Not anywhere near good enough for me for that kind of final decision. But again, if it's all you got, maybe that's good enough to get you to the use you need along with some land use controls. So what we came out with, DoD was working on advanced geophysical classification. This is an electromagnetic technology. I think that's the TEMTAD system on the top and the MPV, the smaller handheld system on the bottom right, where this technology is looking at, it's more of a 3D look of the response to different sensors. And you can tell based on the decay and all of, you know, you can tell very easily between like a flat plate, a piece of wire, and a pipe type object, you know, a munitions kind of cylindrical thick walled object. And you can really cut down on the amount of dangerous digs that you need to do and really dig what you need to do. Maybe you dig everything, but you don't have to dig if you have a high confidence the other items are not bad, but maybe you want to get rid of them anyway. You can dig those under different protocols. You know, there are a lot of things for that. So as we were, the CERDEP, you see the Strategic Environmental Research Development Program is DoD's basic research program. And the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, ESTCP, is their kind of field test pilot testing program. So this was developed under CERDEP and then fielded under ESTCP. When they were starting to develop it and field it, they actually developed an advisory group. And I was part of that with some others with EPA and several state experts. We were really concerned with this is still dependent on the geophysicist interpretation of the data. And how well do we know, hey, are they trained? Is the contractor keeping track of that? What's their quality through the, you know, it's a lot of based on the contractor. So we started asking a lot of questions, and DoD's response was to come up with this, well, a new acronym, which they love, and it's DADCAP, the DoD Advanced Geophysical Classification Accreditation Program. So they actually have an accreditation program. They base this on the lab technology certification program and that's actually the folks that they brought in to help set this up. And to really, you know, anyone who's doing work for DoD that's doing advanced geophysical classification has to be accredited, period. If they're doing that work, if they lose their accreditation, they're done. They can't do the work anymore until they get reaccredited. So it's a two-year accreditation. There was there's basically a paperwork certification kind of, and making sure they have quality systems in place and all that. And then there's actually the field test portion of it, which they're now for recertification, they're looking at just synthetic data sets and all. But it's a really good way for regulators and stakeholders to understand they really are doing the work. They know what they're doing, and here is why. Here's the data to show that they know what they're doing. They've been tested out. They know what they're doing. They've been certified, and they have to recertify. So that is actually a good thing. So I mentioned this before, the UFP QAP, and here's our quiz. See if we can get above 90% people on this.
So what does UFP QAP stand for? Uniform Font Program for Quality Assurance and Proposed Plans. Understated Facts Project for Quality Assumption Project Plans. Uniformed Federal Policy for Quality Aggregated Pilot Programs, or Uniform Federal Policy for Quality Assurance Project Plans. Get your answers in. And I don't think this has been covered in this presentation yet, so
it has not.
Do not be shy with wrong answers.
All right, it looks like about 3/4 of the audience have submitted their responses, so I'm going to go ahead, and they're pretty confident in their answers. All right, let me lock this one down and share those results.
Good. All right.
99%.
Nice. This has been out for a while, so I'm glad to hear folks have been paying attention. That's great. Get it to work. There we go. So what is it? It's a tool to guide project teams through the systematic planning process. This was developed, this was originally developed for a chemical type of investigation. This is a worksheet-based tool. There are 37 worksheets in the original version. We've streamlined them. There's new versions that were put out. And then we started looking at it. This is really, really working well in the chemical side of the cleanup program. We're cutting down on the number of regulator reviews. People are understanding where the, you know, the quality indicators are in their project and where to find things, how the project is being run. It really does work well. There's a bit of a learning curve. There was a bit of a learning curve with contractors learning how to write them and do them well. And for regulators to understand them. I think this is the number one thing I'm still helping out with our folks is looking at UFP QAP and trying to explain why some things are some way. So what we did, we looking at doing quality assurance for munitions and geophysics work is a whole lot different than chemical QAQC. I don't know if we have any chemists on here. I'm an engineer. I dabble in some chemistry, but I understand, even I understand it's a lot different. It is way different. So we actually, we did this in a little bit backwards order. There is an AGC, Advanced Geophysical Classification QAP, we did first. So DOD had actually taken it upon themselves to start developing their own QAP templates to use. So those were in existence, but everybody was, as we were developing this AGC technology, folks were having difficulty trying to apply this. So we did take this on as a group and developed one. And then we went back and developed module one, which is this RIFS UFP QAP. That one has been out. It was updated once already. We're probably gonna have some minor updates again later this year. Is being used primarily. DOD requires UFP QAP format. For all of their projects. EPA is requiring it throughout our private cleanups as well. You know, we've just issued some new contracts and how we do our work, but we are using it as well. It works really well. We left the numbering of the worksheets the same, but there are quite substantial difference in content. So the RIFS, the module one is actually what our class that we just held our fourth online version of it due to COVID, and we're hoping to get an in-person course this summer in, really is based on this UFP QAP and how we go about doing the work. The module two is under draft right now. We're kind of incorporating this AGC QAP into this. This is gonna be the remedial action QAP. This one, we're hoping that it'll be released this spring for some review. Actually, it is out for review right now. Some folks, wider review later this summer, hopefully to issue maybe by the end of the year. This is the one I mentioned, the UUUE scenario. We tried to incorporate a UUUE scenario in this on how you could actually get to that and what quality indicators and quality assurance you would need along the way to get to that. And those are just examples, but boy, they took a while to work through. We have a team of EPA, state, and DOD, and some contractors assisting us to work through it. And it took a while to get to an agreement, even on an example where we were making up the example. So certainly something to look for coming out in the near future. So we partner a lot with DOD to try to maximize the transparency and collaboration. I have the phone numbers of everybody who does this at DOD. My folks and regulators don't hesitate to contact me, and I can get a hold of anybody at DOD and try to resolve issues. We want to keep the work going. We want to get the sites cleaned up correctly. You know, I did mention the UXO management principles earlier in the training. This was in March of 2000, where EPA and DOD agreed we need to work together. We need to work together well. We need to use digital geophysical methods. It has taken a while to get that fully implemented, but I really do think it is there. So a couple of the other groups, we have a munitions response dialogue. If over the years, we've had different variations of this due to funding and other reasons. So this is where we are now. It's a dialogue group. It's co-chaired by DOD, Office of Secretary of Defense. Brian Jordan is the new person there. I'm the representative for EPA and the co-chair. And then we have a state co-chair, which right now is Tracy White from the state of California, Colorado, excuse me. We have several, I think we have 9 other states participating on this group, EPA, every DOD service, federal land management agencies. And we really talk through a lot of issues that are related nationally to this munitions cleanup program. Topic of the last year and a half, 2 years has been this risk management methodology that DOD has been pushing forth. And we had the subgroup working through what are our big issues to it, which resulted in DOD making some big edits to it and then sending it back out to the groups to review and submit comments, which we all just did. And hopefully we'll get a revised version back in a couple of months to look at and try to move that forward and get it to be a better, more usable tool. Didn't mention this before, but the Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force, the IDQTF, is the group. It's chaired by out of my office, by my boss, and DOD, Office of Secretary of Defense, and DOE has been involved as well. And it's really trying to, a group working to standardize data quality across federal government and cleanups. This is the group that developed the UFP QAP. So you can blame them. I picked it up when we started doing munitions, and now I'm our lead representative for it still as we're working on other things. So other munitions sites that can cause us some issues, I'm not spending a lot of time on them because I don't do a lot with that. I'll hit the second one first. Operational ranges. For the most part, you know, munitions used for their intended purposes are exempt. There may be issues on operational ranges that need to be addressed. There could be previous landfills, disposals, other things. We do try to work with DOD to be responsive and respectful of what their, you know, their national security mission is and getting what needs to be done. But if something needs to be cleaned up, it needs to be cleaned up. There have been cases where we've had to take action and do some things on ranges. It's not very often. I do suggest to regulators, if this is starting to be an issue for EPA, please bring it to our attention at headquarters. Nothing gets elevated more quickly than an issue with an operational range, I have found over the years. And we can certainly help advise you in what the best path forward to do. Keep in mind, any work that would be done, say if there was an old landfill that was really impacting groundwater and going offsite, just an example, it needed to be, that's not DERP eligible, DOD's own program. So they'd have to have a different funding source for that, which can also cause some issues within DOD. You know, even if they, you know, recognize the need to do something, the funding can be kind of an issue. So going back up, the open burn, open detonation sites are usually permitted sites. There is a lot of stuff going on right now. Our Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, OROCR, doing the RECRA, folks have an explosives team that are working on OBOD and permitting. They have a work group with DOD, which I sit in and listen in on. I think there will be, they're working on some clarification, guidance, and also possibly even a new rulemaking. It's been a long time since anything was issued regarding OBOD. It was an alternatives technology document that was issued, I want to say 2 years ago. Losing track of time during COVID and working out of my house only, but that is a great document to read. Certainly something you could even consider as you're looking at treatment. You know, if you have munitions that can be moved on your site, you certainly can look at that to see what other alternatives there are for treating those kind of wastes. Let's see. So here we are. We at NPL sites, we oversee DOD's cleanup. We're usually in the CERCLA process. However, there are some reasons to be under, you know, RECRA, if there were permits and stuff and being cleaned up. We've had to issue some orders and work under Safe Drinking Water Act per se, but CERCLA really is the preferred. It's a cleanup statute. It works well for working through that. And again, the thing to keep, if you're new to this, is it's the same process. You know, there's a different name for the MMRP program, but the fundamental law and that and statute that they're following is, you know, is CERCLA to get to the end point. So here we are. I think we've got about 13 or so minutes. I know if you want to put questions in, I know Emily's doing me the great service of going through and looking at questions. Do not hesitate to reach out to me. If we can't get to all your questions today, give me a call. Shoot me an email is probably the best. And we'll try to get back to you. So Emily, do we have any other questions?
We have some great questions. I'll go ahead and start. If munitions are demilitarized on site, the filler drummed and disposed offsite as waste, and the metal casings recycled, would this be exempted from RCRA?
Can we repeat that?
Yes. If
okay,
I
I'm gonna pull it up.
Go back to the question.
And do you need help finding it, Emily?
No, I've got it. If munitions are demilitarized on site, the filler drummed and disposed offsite as waste, and the metal casings recycled, would this be exempted from RCRA?
I mean, I think so. But I don't know that I'm going to give that the definitive answer right now, because that's not my normal realm of RCRA. So let me get back to them specifically on that.
Okay.
So I don't give a wrong answer. I know my limits.
Does the EPA guidance on munitions address whether the findings of a munition at a non-DOD FUD site constitutes a release of hazardous substances under CERCLA? Specifically, would the finding of a single mech on federally owned property trigger a CERCLA 120 notification of a release that might prompt including the site on the FF hazard waste compliance docket?
Wow, that's a really loaded question.
Yeah.
It might. I mean, certainly, so the answer I'll give you is munitions that are no longer on the operational range, there's no exemption to them. And if they're discarded, then if there's explosive in them, they would be a hazardous waste and then potentially also a hazardous substance. But I think you can take it from there as to whether that would trigger the docket. But there's no exempt anything once you're off an operational range.
Okay.
And if you have that one seems to be, I think there's a situation in mind. As far as the hazardous waste compliance docket goes, there's a person in my office that works on that too. And that maybe if that's a site-specific question, we can get he and I on the line and talk you through it.
All right. What depth of investigation is considered cleared? Is clearance excavation of the depth of investigation or repeated clearance a common practice?
So this is another thing about terminology. So surface clearance, you know, versus a clearance to depth, you know, or a cleanup. Once you... Yeah, that it depends on how good your QAQC were. You know, are you saying how deep? I guess the question is, it's hard to understand too. How deep can you see for geophysical instruments? I guess the rule of thumb is about 11 times the diameter. If you can't see it, you can't tell if it's there or not. So you certainly couldn't say if you had small munitions going to a deeper depth, you certainly could not say that it was cleared, you know, and that you were good to go. In that case, you may have to cut off lifts of property or, you know, of the land to be able to get closer to do it. In those cases, a lot of the times with the smaller munitions that go a little deeper than we can find it, you're stuck with land use controls. You know, it's very difficult to clean that up.
Okay.
And again, I'm going to encourage people, if I really didn't answer your question well, and you want to resubmit it to me, certainly do.
It's going to say that while your contact information is still on the screen.
Yes,
so that's helpful.
Yes. You can type your email right now if you need to.
Have you found the soil from FUD sites to be contaminated with lead exposure within artillery and mortar ranges?
Not as much. No, nowhere near like, no, we're going to exclude small arms range from that, which is just firing bullets into, you know, berms and stuff like that. There, I would certainly, if it was an area that was used to take a look. I've not seen the most heavily contaminated sites I see with explosives and metals and all that are usually, for my area, OBOD, maybe some disposal sites, and then for explosives, anything manufacturing or decommissioning or something like that would be the much higher level of contamination. Doesn't mean you shouldn't take a look.
Okay. If digs show vertical emplacement, i.e. highest EM response, can a deeper depth of investigation be justified?
So what this is referring to, I think, is if you say you have a long cylindrical object and it's pointing vertically, when you're looking down on it with your sensor, you will be able to find that there's so much more metal in that look downward versus it being horizontal and you're looking at it crossways. I don't know that munitions end up in the environment any given way. Certainly, so we usually do the maximum, you know, the minimum depth where you can find everything. We'll usually look at that least favorable orientation for, you know, of the horizontal position where that's the least amount of metal when you're looking kind of crossways down from the surface onto it. And we'll look at that as kind of the depth of detection. You can certainly find them deeper, but reliably so, no. What if it's at 45 degrees? It's not going to be that deep. So I wouldn't use that as saying it's cleaned up.
Okay. Can you speak to the challenges specific to underwater sites?
Yeah, it's more expensive and more difficult. So DOD's R&D had spent considerable time and effort with land-based systems and sensors. A lot of that work has transitioned into underwater type of work. I actually sit on these panels reviewing their technology development and all and provide regulator input. There's a lot that's pushing towards looking at underwater sites. Keep in mind, when you go underwater, everything's more expensive and more difficult. Things do not land the same way if they're shooting into water-based targets, maybe more dispersed. So maybe your statistical tools don't work as well for transect design. So there's a lot of questions that go there. DOD has been doing some investigations and cleanups so far that we've been involved with. But again, it's somewhat early days for those. There are technologies out. We can survey and find things underwater and clean them up. But again, it's definitely more difficult.
Okay. I'm aware of a bombing range that is being closed by the state, not EPA. I'm trying to understand why. It's associated with an active delisted Air Force base. Any thoughts?
It sounds to me like that might actually be a guard, Air Guard issue, because they do have, that's the only thing I can think of, is that the state may actually be a potential party to it based on the National Guard units, the Air Guard or the Army National Guard, they have state as well as federal duties. And I have seen where the state has been responsible for them. It depends on what they did there. I think that could have something to do with it. If not, that one's probably a good site specific question to send me more info on and we can talk about it.
Okay. I realize that it's very important to remove mech and UXO. Some military ranges also include small arms munitions with lead bullets. While some responsible parties have pushed for not removing lead bullets in the past, once the range is closed, any remaining lead bullets have levels of lead, making them hazardous waste. Lead bullets also weather and release lead into the soil and water, mainly as lead carbonates, over decades to centuries. So, if lead bullets remain, lead concentration in soil will increase over time. Is EPA developing policy to clarify the cleanup of lead bullets on small arms ranges?
We are not actively working on any new guidance. There are some out. There's some best management practices, ITRC document. We did write, our federal facilities work group did write a pretty extensive paper. I don't know if to call it guidance, but it's certainly useful information on munitions constituent cleanup. And in that was quite a bit of information on small arms ranges in there.
We've made it through the questions.
All right. 3 minutes left. Well, folks, I want to thank you all for attending. Again, any further questions, concerns, or anything, please don't hesitate to reach out to me and or Emily.
Yes, and or Emily.
All right. Well, if it's okay with you, Doug, I think I will take it away with just a few final reminders for our audience before we close things out in our session today. So the first thing that I would like to do is just to remind everybody, we may have had a few attendees join us a little bit late and missed this part. We're just reminding everybody that today's session was part of an ongoing webinar series. So this was the third one in the series. We'll be back again next month for our next delivery on May 11th, which will cover land use and on-site, off-site determinations. I did want to remind everybody that this is part of that ongoing Federal Facilities Academy, which includes 11 online webinars, which are open to the public, and then an in-person delivery, which is 3 days long and is open to a restricted audience of EPA, states, tribes, and other federal regulators. And we do have information about that classroom delivery. If you need it, you can certainly send a message into me in the Q&A, but we've already included it as a resource on the seminar homepage for our session, which I'm going to talk about in just a moment. If you enjoyed our session, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org and connect with us on that site. And of course, please be sure that you're subscribed to our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month and will highlight free online training opportunities such as today's session. If you happen to have a resource that you think will be a valuable addition to Tech Direct, you are also welcome to send it to me at ballant.jean@epa.gov. As I highlighted at the start of our session, there is a webpage that has been created and dedicated for today's webinar. It's shown in red on the top of this text. There are a series of tabs or sections that as you scroll through that page, you'll have access to things such as the webinar slides and references. There's information about our speakers, including contact information if you want to follow up with any of them, and then links to our online feedback form. So I'm going to ask you all to make sure that you have either bookmarked or you reference this page, because that is how you can request a participation certificate based off of filling out the feedback form on the seminar homepage. If you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, that website is still available and you can still submit feedback. So as we were highlighting in the beginning of our class today, you can receive a participation certificate for any or all of the online webinars that you attend, whether you're there live or replay the recorded version. Simply fill out the online feedback form associated with the webinar and make sure that you check the box at the bottom of the form certifying that you attended either the entire live delivery or replayed the entire recording. As long as you check that box and include a valid email address once you submit your feedback form, you will have access to a participation certificate, something like this one that you can save for your own records. We'll also email a copy of it to you, but sometimes those get blocked by junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it from the confirmation page and just save it right when you submit your form in. If you happen to have a number of people join at your location, each person can actually fill out that feedback form on their own, even if they didn't register individually. So if you happen to be the one who signed up for the session, please get them that link to the seminar feedback form so they can fill it out and get their own certificate for their own records. And so again, our session was recorded. We had well over 170 individuals to join us for today's live broadcast. We hope that you will carry on with the seminar. And again, please bookmark the URL shown in red here. If you happen to be watching the recorded version, you'll be able to type that URL in, or right about now, somewhere over my head in the recorded version online in the archive, there should be a button that will allow you to jump straight to this page so you can fill out the feedback form. So with that, I want to thank both of our instructors and organizers from the Federal Facilities Office here for putting on our session, and all of you who took time out of your busy days to join us for the session. We hope that this was a valuable expenditure of your time and you will join us for a future webinar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining.